The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
There we go. All together, we're actually we the people. Separately, we're nowhere.
But together.
We're just faces in a crowd.
Separately, we're I the person.
Nice. Just in case we ever break up the band, you know, and we got to go our separate ways.
Yeah. We don't have to be we.
Oh, my gosh. So everything is situated today for the people who listened last week. We had that scurry at the beginning and, you know, all those failed phone call attempts. Today is going off without a hitch. Can believe it or not, it's daylight savings time. That usually throws us a curveball.
No, it's no longer daylight savings time.
Well, that's true. It's the stupid hour change. Yeah, we'll just call it the stupid hour change.
Yeah, we've been caught on that before, haven't we?
We've been busted on that. Oh. We do poorly in the spring.
Where is everybody?
We seem to navigate fall well, but spring we kind of stink at. So this afternoon we have with us Christine Harbin Hansen. She's the Deputy Director of Federal Affairs for the Americans for Prosperity. And so you've been hearing all this stuff about the XM Bank. And, you know, people just don't know a lot about it. So today they're talking about the efforts in Congress, which actually worked. This is a little bit after the fact. This is from Christine, to revive the corrupt Export-Import Bank. The bank, which provided American taxpayer-backed loans and loan guarantees to foreign companies, had a history of questionable deals and conduct and was recently allowed to expire when up for legal authorization. And I'm not going to read the whole rest of it because that's the stuff she's going to tell us about. But, Christine, I don't have a bio for you, so maybe you could tell us something about your real self.
Oh, sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you and Bill.
Thanks for making the time.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm with Americans for Prosperity. We are the largest conservative grassroots organization. We have 38 chapters across the country, nearly 3 million activists, and I handle our federal affairs. So I'm based here in Washington, and I've been working very closely with people on Capitol Hill on this important issue.
Very good. And So the whole, give us a little snapshot of what the Export-Import Bank, if it was running well, how about this, what would it do?
Well, our position at
possible?
Americans for Prosperity is that there would be, this is such a level of government meddling in the marketplace.
Yeah.
If it were running well, in our opinion, it wouldn't exist. So.
Yeah, I realized after I said it, I'm like, that was probably the wrong question.
Best case scenario.
So for the people who would make, how about this? For the people who would make the case that we like it, what would be their take on it? Because the rest of the show, we're going to talk about why we don't like it.
Definitely. Well, what we hear from XM beneficiaries and supporters is that it's good for job creation, that it boosts exports, and it's very good for the manufacturing sector across the country. But these are a lot of politically charged talking points that don't really match up with reality. And so we've been spending a lot of our time and efforts at Americans for Prosperity in disputing these myths about the Export-Import Bank and calling on our partners on Capitol Hill to let it expire and also, almost more importantly, let it stay expired.
Exactly. You know, can you give people a little snapshot of what it does, what it actually does?
The Export-Import Bank has been around since 1934, so it's been around for a really long time, and until recently, very few people knew a lot about it. But what it does is it provides favorable rates to companies to buy American products. So it's intended to boost exports. And boosting exports does sound like it's a good idea. Of course, we want to have a thriving exporting economy and send our American-made goods abroad. However, the problem with the Export-Import Bank is that it uses Americans' tax dollars to do it, and it put American families and businesses on the hook if any of these loans go belly up.
So most people out there wouldn't deal with this at all. They would have no, they wouldn't even know any of this was going on behind the scenes.
Well, very few people know about the Export-Import Bank, but here's the thing. The more they learn about it, the more they hear it, the more they oppose it. And
true.
So we've been seeing at the grassroots level and also on Capitol Hill, an increasing opposition to extending the Export-Import Bank. However, unfortunately, beneficiaries and supporters of XM are well-connected in Washington, and so they're very effective in lobbying and people here to extend their handout. And that's one of the things that we're seeing right now with recent activities on the Export-Import Bank. Even though Congress let it expire in June, we saw the House pass a bill this past week that would resurrect the Export-Import Bank. And the Senate is poised to consider similar legislation. So even though the bank expired, the issue is still very active.
So does the Ex-Im Bank have anything to do with setting tariffs, or either directly or indirectly with setting tariffs on imports?
No, it doesn't do anything like that. What it is, it helps with financing instead of dealing with tariffs or other types of quotas or other international issues. What the Export-Import Bank does is it provides favorable lending rates to companies in order to that export their goods. So we see a lot of this in the manufacturing sector. A lot of big, well-connected companies are strong supporters of this.
But then
what I will
hurt, but it hurts our guys here, because I had heard I don't know if I read it or heard it. It was with Boeing. And if you were an overseas company and you wanted to buy a plane, you actually got a really good deal. But if you wanted to buy a plane here, you paid significantly more.
That's true. We see a lot of domestic companies that are directly hurt by it, by the activities of the Export-Import Bank. And so if you're a domestic airline company, you're not able to buy airplanes at the same favorable rate as some of their overseas competitors. So while we hear Export-Import Bank beneficiaries and supporters talk about how this is a great thing for job creation, the problem is that it overlooks all the harms that it imposes, not just on domestic companies who compete with these foreign companies, but it also is a problem for American taxpayers as well, because they're on the hook for these loans if there's a problem with them. So there are a lot of really harmful effects that happen on the overall economy, and those are some of the things that we've been trying to educate on in our activities on the issue over the past 2 years.
And do you have any idea how much money we're talking about in loans through the Ex-Im Bank?
The Ex-Im Bank does have a lending cap. There's well over $100 million. I don't have the full number in front of me, but I do know that it's losing money. A nonpartisan analysis from the Congressional Budget Office highlighted that since the bank doesn't accurately account for the risk associated with these loans, it's actually losing $2 billion over the next decade.
So they use
real money.
Yeah, so they use taxpayers' money, and they're not making a profit. Boy, that seems odd, doesn't it?
So I can hear people asking, okay, so why would American companies want to use taxpayer funds to sell things cheaper to overseas companies? Not just sell them cheaper overseas, but give those companies an advantage over American companies. Who's actually kind of architecting this behind the scenes?
Ex-Im beneficiaries are the ones who are really calling hard on Congress to extend this because they're directly benefiting from these favorable rates. Unfortunately, due to the fact of in economics we call this concentrated benefits diffuse costs, and what that means is that the people who are shouldering the burden don't have as strong of an incentive to lobby their members of Congress and their elected officials to let this, bad government program expire. And so that's one of the reasons that we've been really focused on this issue at Americans for Prosperity, because we represent the grassroots voice. And so we've been working closely with AFC activists in the field and really highlighting the problems associated with the Export-Import Bank, highlighting the fact of using this corporate welfare program to send our tax dollars abroad to many companies that are state-owned in countries that don't really like us very much. So we've been educating activists on the issues and connecting them to their elected officials on Capitol Hill to encourage them to let the Export-Import Bank stay expired.
So if we give tax money to foreign companies, I guess we give them money to produce products to sell back to the United States. Am I getting that right?
No. What we do is the Export-Import Bank uses the tax dollars to give favorable rates for companies abroad to buy our products.
Okay. So what is our ability to collect on those loans if they go bad, if it's a foreign country and they decide, oh, we can't pay it back, or is that just common, they never pay it back?
Well, unfortunately, in that situation, American taxpayers would be on the hook in order to come up with the difference. So there's a lot of really concerning things associated with it.
Is that happening?
We have seen in the past some in the 1980s, the Export-Import Bank sought a bailout from American taxpayers on the issue. We haven't seen very egregious examples of late, but what we have been seeing is a culture of corruption. We've seen a lot of Ex-Im Bank employees get in situations where they're soliciting bribes or kickbacks in order to extend these loans. The way I think about it is, you know, the Ex-Im Bank already picks winners and losers, and then among those winners and losers, there's, you know, another level of winners and losers. So the fact of the matter is that this is not only is it plain old corporate welfare, but it's also there's a lot of corruption at the bank. And the fact of the matter is American families and businesses deserve to have their tax dollars go spent more effectively than at this crony bank.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Do they have to abide by the same banking laws that regular domestic banks have to abide to?
What they do, they don't have to account for their risk the same way. There's some really concerning accounting practices at the Export-Import Bank. They don't have to use fair value analysis. And what the problem is there, like other banks do, and the problem with that is that the bank doesn't show the higher risk as effectively. So when you do a fair value analysis, like CBO recently did, it shows that the bank is losing money.
Interesting. We need to take a really quick break. When we come back, I'm kind of curious how many people work for the Export-Import Bank. I'm interested in actually the mechanics of it because we just don't hear about it unless there's a big fight like there has been recently. So, anyway, you are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online for more information about our guest, Christine Hansen. And you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Ain't gonna let those goons get justice. He makes his living off of the people's taxes. Part two, whoa, will she spend away? Billy Joe caught up to the very next day. They got the money, hey, you know they got away. They headed down south and they're still running.
That'd be Mexico. That's really south.
Down south. Who said the Ex-Im Bank didn't have a theme song?
That's right.
It's a lie. We found it here. You're listening to We the People Radio. We are being joined this afternoon by Christine Harbin Hansen. She's the Deputy Director of Federal Affairs for Americans for Prosperity. And we're getting a lesson in the Export-Import Bank because we don't know anything about it.
So
we had all sorts of questions on the break, but can you tell us how big an institution this is before we get too far down the road?
Oh, well, it's not large when you consider in the grand scheme of Washington spending or the number of XM employees. It actually is relatively small XM, small federal agency. However, one of the problems with it is that it really symbolizes a lot of the problems with government involvement in the banking and financing sector.
Sure.
And so that's why we've been so focused on it.
And so, just to kind of boil it down, because I think I'm still a little bit confused. We loan money to companies overseas so that they can buy our domestic products. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. What countries do they deal with?
We see XM loans go across the world. We see them actually to countries like Canada and Western Europe, but we also see the XM loans go to companies based in Russia, in Southeast Asia. It's across the world. We've spent billions of dollars of taxpayer-backed loans throughout the world.
And do they loan money to companies overseas that are owned or partially owned by American entities?
We see these loans go to a variety of different companies. Some of them are actually going to state-owned businesses. So XM dollars are going to companies that are like state-owned.
By the government of Russia or owned by the government of India. Okay,
mm-hmm.
but not so much companies that have American partners. So there's no American companies that are benefiting on the loan side by doing business overseas.
One of the problems with the Export-Import Bank is that it has a number of requirements that it routinely fails to meet. And one of these, for example, is a requirement that a certain percentage of its loans go to small businesses. And you'll hear this talking point from XM supporters and beneficiaries that they imply that these are going to mom-and-pop businesses. A prime example recently was that they highlighted earlier was a pickle manufacturer, Miss Jenny. She would use the Export-Import Bank loans in order to export pickles. But the problem is when you look at where these XM dollars are going, around 80% of it is going to large politically connected companies, ones that could very easily get financing on the private market. And many of these companies do in fact get private financing on the private market. So the fact of the matter is that this is really just helping large politically connected companies. It's plain old corporate welfare, and that's really disputes a lot of the talking points from XM supporters.
Sharon, what's the, I don't know if it'd be technically called a default rate, but I mean, how many times do we not get paid back on these loans? And then what's the, you know, are they as bad at re-lending to those folks? Like, I mean, I'm picturing the housing, you know, the housing bubble. Like, here were people who couldn't afford the loans they were getting, but we loaned them to them anyway, and then we put on our shocked face when it didn't get paid. Is this the same sort of circle we see?
Well, it's certainly a continuing concern. One of the problems associated with it is that there's always a risk that taxpayers will have to pick up the tab.
Sure.
One of the interesting things that came out of a House hearing earlier on the issue, they had a small domestic airline manufacturer talking about how he actually had been approved for a loan on the private market, but he wasn't comfortable with putting up his house. He wasn't comfortable with, you know, putting up his own resources as collateral. And so that's why he sought a loan from the Export-Import Bank. But really this, you know, there's a lot of really concerning things when it comes to how this shifts a lot of the risk away from the companies and the innovators, and it's shifting it onto the American people who are still struggling in the down economy.
Yeah, no kidding. And so we were able to sidestep the reauthorization of it in June?
June is when the Export-Import Bank expired. So this is one of those opportunities where Congress can do the right thing by doing nothing.
Sure.
So AFP was very thrilled to see Congress let this bank expire. But unfortunately, what we're seeing right now are some efforts underway in Congress to extend the Export-Import Bank. And actually, the House recently voted in support of it. They passed a legislation. They actually forced it out of committee using a esoteric parliamentary tactic known as a discharge petition to force a floor vote on final passage. And they passed it last week with a vote of 313-118, which is very concerning.
Yeah, that many people were in favor of it. Now, is this, just out of curiosity, is this something that Democrats love to hate and the Republicans like, or what is there a party line sort of preference here?
There is a really interesting dynamics going on when you look at the breakdown by party. We see consistent support from House Democrats. So on the vote last week, there was all but one House Democrat voted for it. They 186
really?
Democrats. Yeah, and then. But when you look at Republicans, they're largely split. So looking at the votes there in the House this past time, there were 127 Republicans who voted yes, and then only 117 who voted no on the legislation. So as I mentioned earlier in the program, people at the grassroots level may not know very much about the bank, but the more that they learn about it, the more that they oppose it. We're seeing the same thing happen with House Republicans as well. The more that they learn about the bank, the more we see people come out and oppose it. And we saw pretty much every significant candidate running for president right now talking about coming out on the record. In both parties, we've seen Republicans running for president, also on the Democratic side as well, people coming out with a position on the issue. It's really interesting to see the dynamics there.
Interesting. Is it the limited government people versus the big government people, or people who have manufacturing in their district?
It's more of a district issue.
Okay.
Based on whether there are a high number of XM beneficiaries in their district.
Sure.
We see, and actually looking at the California delegation, the Republicans are pretty split. We did see only a small number. Most California lawmakers voted in support of the Export-Import Bank. In fact, in total, looking at both parties, 48 did. But there were five. There were five House Republicans from California who voted against it. They stood up and did the right thing.
And what type of manufacturing in California would benefit from this program?
I'm sure there's a great variety. I'm sure there's a lot of we see a lot of support for the Export-Import Bank in the airline industry, and I know that California is not that strong there, but California is a huge economy, and so of course there's going to be a high number of
sure.
beneficiaries.
Jerry Brown's doing his very best to make us not the sixth largest economy. Yeah, in no time at all, we'll be almost a non-player in the XM Bank. It won't matter at all.
I will say though, this is one of those issues where you have a lot of opposition to extending XM among leadership. Kevin McCarthy was joining. He had some great statements on the floor. He joined House Financial Services Committee Chairman Jeb Hensarling on the floor leading up to the vote and talked about how he was, his consistent opposition to the Export-Import Bank. We see a lot of support, we see people in leadership and also in the Republican Study Committee and also many members of the House Freedom Caucus who are on the far right of the House Republicans. We see a lot of people come out and oppose it.
Yeah, I know our congressman here in Northern California opposed it. I didn't have a chance to look at all the votes, so I wasn't really sure if it was a Democrat thing, a Republican thing. It sounds like it's a district thing, you know, and that makes a lot of sense. That's where the pressure would come in.
Yeah, the five House Republicans from California who voted the right way on the issue by opposing final passage were LaMalfa, McCarthy, McClintock, Rohrabacher, and Royce.
Interesting. And since we also air in the Philadelphia and New Jersey market, I don't know what you have at your fingertips, but maybe before the end of the program, since they'll hear this on Monday, maybe we could give a little overview on what their guys were mostly doing.
I actually have it right now in front of me.
Okay, well, far
we only
away.
We saw a similar dynamic happen in Pennsylvania as well. Only two people, only two House Republicans stood up and voted against it. Perry and Rothfuss voted nay, and the rest of the Pennsylvania delegation voted in support of it. So 16 Pennsylvania lawmakers, unfortunately, did not stand up for taxpayers and were swayed by special interests and extended the Export-Import Bank.
Interesting. What about New Jersey?
One second. Since I can pull that up.
Since we're scrolling through the list there, I guess I always feel like if we say something that makes everybody call them Monday and they didn't vote for it, we might as well just, you know, save everybody the hassle.
Well, it's really important to... you know, because it's not over yet. It's really important to call on Senate leaders to be firmer than the House in opposing this legislation, and also to remind members of Congress that even if the vote happened in the past and you disagreed with it, it's important to let them know that as well. So in New Jersey, Garrett and Lance voted against the legislation, but the rest of the New Jersey delegation supported the bank as well.
Interesting. We'll be right back. We've got more questions. The longer we talk, the more questions we're developing here. And you'll have to be sure and let us know if we're not hitting things that you wanted to cover, since you are the expert, and we obviously are not. We'll be back with Christine Harbin Hansen from Americans for Prosperity. We're talking about the XM Bank. We should call it the elusive XM Bank. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
I was just a child, my life was all so simple, and the ways of the great world seemed strange and funny. Then when I was a young man, I learned of that machine. Turns out all those bales of precious money.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's the new theme song of the Export-Import Bank. I know it's James Taylor, but what was that?
It's called Money Machine.
Wow, that's bizarre.
One of his tracks off of In the Pocket from the mid-70s.
Well, who knew? How did I get through the mid-70s without hearing that song? What a kick. All right, you're rejoining We the People Radio. Okay, Christine, I've got a question for you. I looked up the, let's see, what is this actually? This is the XM Bank's website, What We Do. I couldn't get past the first, no, it's like this, actually the third sentence. It says, the bank is an independent federal agency, which is kind of a misnomer right away, that fills gaps in private export finance in order to bolster U.S. job growth at no cost to American taxpayers.
Yeah, what's
that? I'm like,
again.
Okay, which part of that was actually correct?
That's like free money.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So how are they allowed to say this? Is it just like every other government thing? They can just say whatever they want, and if you don't actually look beyond it, you don't know?
Well, they're using, as we mentioned before, the bank has a different set of accounting practices and accounting practices that allow it to hide the fact that it's losing taxpayer dollars. So when you do use fair value accounting, when you accurately account for the risk, you see that the Ex-Im Bank is actually costing American taxpayers $2 billion over the next decade. And one other point I would add is that the bank's outstanding liabilities that the U.S. taxpayers are ultimately on the hook for, have risen from about $51 billion in 2007 to $134 billion in 2014. Wow. So it's a significant rise.
It is. And see, on their own website, it says that they have a $675 million surplus generated for American taxpayers in fiscal year 2014. So, they're literally promoting themselves as a money-making.
Moneymaker.
Yeah. They support 164,000 jobs, supposedly, and nearly 90% of the Ex-Im Bank transactions directly supported small businesses.
Well, one of the problems with these job numbers is that Ex-Im supporters routinely overstate them. So we hear from various groups that Ex-Im supports, for example, 46,000 jobs in Florida or 180,000 jobs in California. But this would account for about 87% of total jobs Ex-Im claims to have, mm-hmm. while Florida and California only receive 14% of Ex-Im authorizations. So,
yeah, that doesn't quite add up.
No,
yeah, it definitely doesn't add up at all.
We hear a lot of really confusing numbers coming from the Ex-Im Bank, but when you look at them in total and you compare them, it's very convenient. It's a lot of fuzzy math.
Exactly. Well, I'm kind of curious about the initial statement that they're an independent federal agency. Independent of what?
Well, that's really a very good point to highlight. Even though the American tax dollars are going to support these loans, there's very little oversight, very little transparency at the bank. And actually, since Americans for Prosperity and our coalition partners have really started highlighting the problems at the bank has become less transparent. They used to have more information about the loans and where they were going on their website, but about a year into our project, Ex-Im took off a lot of this data. So taxpayers deserve to have, more accountability for their money, because this is real money. This is, other things that they would spend, save, or invest in the private sector. If they didn't have to go and prop up crony agencies like the Export Import Bank.
Well, if they're using taxpayer money, isn't that public record where they're actually sending it and using it and how much they're making and spending and so forth?
And their type of accounting, is there no requirement that they not use a sleight of hand method of accounting?
Hmm. Well, the fact of the matter is that there is very little transparency at the bank. So taxpayers do not have a clear idea of where this money is going, and that's why it's really important to call on Congress and encourage them to let it expire, but also demand some accountability at the bank, because what we've seen is a lot of problems, a long history of corruption. We've seen over the past few years several senior-level bank employees been implicated in accepting cash payments or kickbacks and bribes, while other bank staffers have also faced criticism for accepting lavish tips and other gifts So it's so important to, you know, really highlight all the wasteful spending that's at this bank. Just like there's a lot of wasteful spending elsewhere in government, but particularly here.
And they are part, who oversees them? I mean, besides, you know, I mean, Congress and all that. But, I mean, where, what are they part of? Are they truly like their own entity out there?
Yes, it's different than some of the other federal agencies that we often hear about, like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Energy. But the Export-Import Bank does have its own inspector general that looks for problems. But separate than that, there's very little oversight for the Export-Import Bank.
Interesting.
Thankfully, we did see a lot of the bank come under scrutiny over the past year in Congress. We saw a series of hearings at House Oversight that really highlighted a lot of the problems at the Export-Import Bank. So we really applaud Oversight Committee Chaffetz for his work in exposing a lot of the problems at the Export-Import Bank, because if that House doesn't do it, then a lot of these problems just wouldn't ever see light.
Now, when they didn't reauthorize it in June, does it just lurk out there? It can always come back? Is that the deal?
Well, what the Export-Import Bank does now, after June, after Congress didn't reauthorize it, or when Congress let it expire, is the bank didn't close up shop right away. It continues to service the loans it currently has.
Sure.
But it's not extending new loans, and that's a really important thing. So it's been expired for the past few months, and it hasn't issued any new credit. But that's why it's so concerning to see these efforts underway in Congress to extend the Export-Import Bank, because if the House and Senate agree to an reauthorization and the President signs it, then it can start to issue more loans, and then we'll see the outstanding liabilities grow, ones that U.S. taxpayers will ultimately be on the hook for.
Well, if it hasn't been reauthorized and they're not issuing new loans, shouldn't that immediately have an effect on the size of their operation? I mean, I would think that their whole loan department would go away if they're just managing what's out there now. Have we seen any of that?
Well, we have seen the Export-Import Bank signal that it will scale down, but this is we haven't really seen anything very significant to that effect. I mean, certainly the Export-Import Bank will go away, but our focus has been the size of the outstanding liabilities. So, yes, it is concerning to have, you know, people who are employed, who are on the government payroll, who are servicing these loans, but the real problem here is the amount that taxpayers are on the hook for.
If they closed right now and what was out there got paid back, how upside down are they? Like,
how upside down would the Export-Import Bank be?
Yeah. How much would we be on the hook for if it just never reauthorized from here forward?
Oh, well, currently, as of 2014, the outstanding liability was $134 billion. So if...
Well, that's a sizable amount of money, $134 billion.
Yeah, we waste that in record time. However, it'd be nice not to just watch it blow away.
Yeah, and there's a lot of... it's bad in practice, and it's also bad in principle. Like, not only is it a problem to have the government intervene in the market to this extent, it's also bad in principle in the way that it's picking winners and losers. One of the things that we hear very frequently from members of Congress who support this is they say things that they want to help businesses in their district. You know, that's what the most common talking point that we hear from XM supporters and beneficiaries. But what we've been pointing out is if you want to help American businesses export more, there are much better ways to do it than extending the Export-Import Bank. And a prime way would be through comprehensive tax reform. You know, currently the United States has a corporate income tax system that's very hostile to domestic investment. It's very hostile to job creation. if members of Congress truly wanted to help businesses export, if they really wanted to, you know, get, you know, help businesses here at home, a much better way to do that would be to lower the rate, the corporate income tax rate, and switch how we assess the corporate income tax, because that would be a way to help businesses without picking and choosing between them.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. We're going to take one last break. We're going to come back, finish up the top of the hour. Christine, you might look through your list of your list of things that we've unfortunately made you ramble through, and we'll give you till the top of the hour to smarten us up, especially for those folks who live in a district where their congressional representative, House or Senate, supports the Ex-Im Bank. You're listening to We the People. Find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Songs about money. We've been listening to them for years and had no idea. You're joining We the People Radio. We are finishing up our first hour here with Christine Harbin Hansen. She's the Deputy Director of Federal Affairs for the Americans for Prosperity. All right, Christine, what didn't we ask? Did we leave out anything good? Uh-oh. Did we lose her?
I'm still here.
Oh, there you are. Did we leave out anything good that people need to know?
No, I think we hit all the main points.
Nice. Okay, so then tell us a little bit about Americans for Prosperity for those folks that don't know anything about it, or it's the group that they love to hate. It's always fun to chat to those people, too.
Definitely. Well, Americans for Prosperity is the country's largest conservative or grassroots organization. We have members in, we have nearly 3 million Americans for Prosperity activists in 37 state chapters. And we promote policies of economic freedom at the state and federal level.
Nice. So you could be involved with almost anything.
Well, it's easier to talk about the issues that we don't work on than the ones that we do work on.
Oh,
but
okay.
Our priority issues right now are budget and spending, taxes, energy policy, and also healthcare policy. We have been one of the longest opponents to the president's healthcare law. We spend a lot of work opposing Medicaid expansion at the state level, exchange creation, and endorsing meaningful efforts to promote free market healthcare policy at the federal level.
That makes sense. So if people wanted to get involved or learn more about your group, what's the best way to do that?
To learn more about Americans for Prosperity and the issues that we work on, folks can go to our website, americansforprosperity.org, or they can get connected with their state chapter.
Interesting.
We have a chapter in California, led by Dave Spady. And also, you mentioned earlier that you're in Pennsylvania as well.
Correct.
Beth Ann Mumford is our state director in Pennsylvania. So I encourage folks, your listeners, to get in touch with Dave and Beth Ann in if they want to get more involved with our organization.
Nice. Americans, it's all spelled out, AmericansForProsperity.org.
Correct.
Nice. And then at the state level, what do people do? You know, I mean, what's your, I guess, as far as activity? Like, if you're just a regular person and you don't have tons of time, you don't have, you know, a whole bunch of money to donate, but you do have an interest, what kinds of things can they do?
Definitely. Well, there's a lot of different ways to get involved in Americans for Prosperity, especially at the state level. One of the things that one of our primary activities is knocking on doors and calling up people on phones and talking to them about important issues and encouraging them to connect with their elected officials at the state level and in promoting good policies. I was actually in Ohio yesterday, for example, attending a energy event. I attended a rally where we were highlighting the harmful impact of the president's so-called clean power plan, his carbon rule, mm-hmm. and the impact that it'll have in Ohio. So in addition to phones and doors, you can also attend rallies. You can also take action online, send notes to your members of Congress and encourage them to do the right thing when they're taking votes. So there's a great variety of ways where people can partner with Americans for Prosperity in promoting free market policy solutions.
Nice. Well, we really appreciate all that because unlike, I don't know, that you'll hear on the mainstream media, the world does not revolve around conservative philosophy, huh?
Well, we aren't seeing a lot of good conservative policies reach the president's desk here on Capitol Hill. So it's certainly easy to get discouraged at the federal level. But on the state level, we're seeing a lot of good conservative successes. We've seen recently a number of states pass right-to-work policies, pass other important labor reforms that will promote worker freedom. We're seeing some states pursue tax reform, like in North Carolina. I know that the state legislature there is certainly standing up for taxpayers and promoting a better tax environment that will put the state in a much better economic shape. So at the state level, we're seeing a lot of successes. There's still a lot of threats, but we're trying to work very closely with folks at the grassroots level and call on state leaders to work on these issues.
And that's so where it's all going to start.
As far as election politics, are you guys getting behind any one person, or are you just waiting to see who comes out?
Well, Americans for Prosperity doesn't endorse candidates, so right. we don't weigh in on
okay, so that's good to know.
On that. So. However, we are closely watching the issue and looking to see, and we're thrilled to see opportunities where issues related to economic freedom are reaching the national narrative.
Well, send us some of your coworkers on other topics. We'd love to hear from you guys.
Thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks a million. Enjoy your free hour today. Thanks, Christine. You've been joining We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back with Lauren Price from Veteran Warriors next hour. Welcome back to We the People. Good afternoon. You're joining your hosts, Aaron and Bill, our engineer, Bob Martin, who had a lot of really good music in the first hour. So if you missed it, we were being the knuckleheads for the XM Bank portion of the program.
We're smart now, though.
We're way smarter than we were when we started.
We just had Bill doing his old job for old time's sake.
we don't do a lot of homework on shows like that, because if we do, then we don't ask any questions, and we don't ask what you probably want to know. But if you were an expert, you were disappointed in us because we were dopes about it. So anyway, we are now being joined by Lauren Price with Veteran Warriors, if I can just simply scroll down my page here. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We try to put all the information for our guests and the topics and the, you know, different things that come up so that you don't have to try to write them while you're driving in your car or whatever you're doing while you're listening. So it's all on there for you. Veteran Warriors is a great organization out of Florida, started by Lauren Price. And I have their I guess, mission statement here. Our goal is to be the catalyst which forces the necessary changes to the manner in which the Department of Veterans Affairs does business with the veteran. God knows that's a lofty mission.
Mm-hmm. Lots of material to work with
and,
there.
And, you know, it's a never-ending mission. So do we have Lauren on there? We had a little calling fun there for a second. Hey, Lauren, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Aaron?
Super. So we didn't really plan anything. I did link the program from March 15th that we had on there with you, and I pulled over some of the similar webpage things. But, you know, you and I were emailing on a case the other day, and I thought, geez, we haven't talked to you in forever. So what's been going on?
Well, as we all are aware, the VA is in the hot seat, as well, much deserved. The Department of Veterans Affairs has come under significant scrutiny because there's an election.
To say the least.
We could call it that.
It's going to be nice.
If significant is like a house just fell on them and all they have are their little stripy legs and their red shoes hanging out, yeah, that's pretty significant.
Yeah. There's a lot of media coverage, but I have to say that it's generated solely because right now there's a presidential race starting, and those candidates are what's the hot topic. So everybody, immigration and veterans. So I had a long talk with representatives of one of the people running for office for the presidency, and that person said, well, I think we need to disband the VA. I said, well, here's the deal. If we disband the VA, we have no mechanism in place currently to take care of our veterans who are coming back from war. And, 600 ground troops back in Syria right now.
With no boots on the ground, they must be wearing some other kind of shoes.
Yeah, they're wearing high heels.
Yeah. That's not too far from the truth from what I've been hearing, though.
That's true.
The most pathetic part is that he actually agrees that, the POTUS agrees, that there are 600 boots on ground in Syria now. But somebody's got to take care of those 600 guys, or the 6,000, or the 60,000, or the 600,000. Or the 22 million who have served in a foreign combat zone, who have served their country, and somebody's got to take care of them. And it doesn't have to be, and I'm not referring solely to medical, but it doesn't have to be a department, which was never, ever set up to be at any point since the Civil War, to be a federal agency. It was set up to be a kind of like the USO. It was kind of an afterthought. Here, we'll throw them a bone. And what happened was, holy crap, we went into World War One, and we had over 250,000 soldiers that went over in World War One and came back and needed help. And then we had World War Two, and we had almost 750,000 soldiers that went over there, soldiers, airmen, Marines, that went over there into Europe and into the Far East and said, we're going to do our job. We come home and we need help. At that point, it was under the Department of the Army and the Secretary of War.
Okay.
Now we have an agency that never was ever set up to be a federal agency, that's been piecemealed together, kind of like Florida clapboard homes, and they're trying to backpedal and fix all the holes. instead of looking forward, and they get warning, Department of Veterans Affairs knew about the Gulf War, knew about the second Gulf War, knew about the invasion, knew about the surge, knew about Vietnam, knew how many veterans were coming home. They were told at every briefing with the POTUS how many veterans were going to be coming home on a monthly basis. And yet they consistently, to this very day, tell everybody, we didn't know, we didn't plan for this, and all this. We can't keep up. And on any given month, there's a reason why they're screwed up. Because then it always falls back to the veteran. Oh, well, the Niemer decision, which allowed Agent Orange claims to come through. Oh, we had the surge in Iraq. Oh, we had the drawdown in Iraq. Oh, we had the end of hostilities in Afghanistan. It's all our fault. Because we suddenly showed up and asked for the services that we were contracted to receive.
But see, that's their only job, is to look out after the veterans. And I mean, they don't have to worry about anything else. I mean, if that's your only job, is to forecast and take care of current problems, I don't get it. And what about this? Well, what if you were going to be an employee of the VA, would it help if you had to be a veteran? Do you think that would make a difference?
No, actually, well, legitimately, 20%, and this is overall agency-wide, they like to talk about over 30% are in claims, but it's overall just slightly over 20% agency-wide are veterans, because we get veterans preference if you're disabled. So if you're 50% disabled, you can get a veterans preference to work there. We have it firsthand from whistleblowers that they will not ever be put in positions where they can make decisions that impact a veteran's benefits or services. So they can go work in the mailroom. They can work in on-the-floor care in healthcare. But they cannot work in a place under the current structure where they can have any impact on benefits or services.
And see, that was my next question, is why not management? Because that's where the big decisions are being made, and that seems like where all the problems are originating is in the management. Why not get somebody in there that understands the problem to help fix it? Because I really truly don't believe they understand it from a veteran's point of view.
Well, I will tell you this: the predecessor to the current secretary was a veteran, General Shinseki. Was a general. He was a four-star general when he was appointed to the secretary position. Except General Shinseki had not served boots on ground in over 30 years. General Hickey, who's now just resigned because she's afraid of having a subpoena stuffed in her face. I've had firsthand conversations directly with her. We call her the advocates in the world. We call her the cheerleader, because that's actually what she was at the Air Force Academy. She was actually a cheerleader for the Air Force football team.
Oh, my gosh.
No, you're kidding me. I'm not
exaggerating. Look up her resume.
Oh, my.
She was a cheerleader for the Air Force football team.
Why am I not surprised? How did she become a general?
None of us are surprised.
How did she become a general?
Up to her very last day, and many are calling it her last love letter, talking about how great the VA is.
Yeah.
I actually had first-hand conversations with her, asking her to account for, there are 10 claims categories. 10. The VA, the VBA, Veterans Benefits Administration, only talks about 4. All the numbers they published have published for over 2 years. They only talk about 4. A reporter who is a local reporter but does national stuff and has worked on VA issues for 15 years asked her point blank, well, is Mrs. Price telling the truth? Well, yes, she is. However, and anytime you say however in the military, we all say comma, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're all getting boned.
The whole truth.
However. Oh, there you go.
I paraphrase General Hickey. The VA and its stakeholders made a decision on what was going to be talked about. The stakeholders, in my humble opinion, as a lowly E6, serving 10 years in the military.
That'd be your humble but accurate opinion?
Extremely humble. My humble opinion is stakeholders means veterans and employees and those who, American taxpayers who are footing the bill. Those are stakeholders. Because when I talk to my mortgage broker or I talk to my financial accountant who handles my finances, he tells me I'm a stakeholder because I have a financial interest in what they're doing. Mm. Apparently, General Hickey's determination of a stakeholder means the VSOs and the union representatives.
Oh, wow.
Because those are the people that made the decision not to talk about the other nine categories of the claims that are being handled, pensions, DIC claims, accrued claims, which are at one point where 700% increase over the year before. Accrued claims are when the veteran dies waiting for their claim to be resolved. Now she's afraid, and the only way to get around being subpoenaed by the House Committee on Veterans Affairs was for her to resign.
Does that really get her off the hook? I mean, can't she still be asked to appear?
It doesn't. The House Committee on Oversight and Investigations will have to request that a federal investigation be opened by the Department of Justice, and Department of Justice will be the only one to be able to subpoena her. Mm. And here's the issue. I've been told by beyond reliable, unimpeachable sources at the House ONI that they have handed numerous hundreds of cases to Department of Justice and have been told they will not open an investigation. Up to and including Tomah, Wisconsin. Up to and including Phoenix, Arizona. Up to and including Haley in Tampa. The DOJ will not open investigations.
And what's their logic on that? Why not?
There's no response. There's no answer as to why they won't.
I guess they don't have to give you a reason.
Don't. They say no, they decline. When you're talking to federal agencies, you get a yes, we will, or no, we won't.
No, we won't. Nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So when people scream and shout and jump on the roofs asking for federal investigations, the investigations have happened by the ONI, by the House Committee, by the chairman, by the vice chairman. These people have opened these investigations. And when they find enough probable cause for wrongdoing that it needs to be referred to DOJ or the OIG, Linda Halliday, God bless her, she has come out repeatedly and said there needs to be DOJ investigation. DOJ continues to walk away. For the longest time, we believed it was Eric Holder. Now we believe it's coming from higher.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, that's an eye-opener. Hey, Lauren, we need to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back. So much on this particular topic. Gosh, I think I need to look up General Hickey's cheerleading record, though, because...
we get a picture.
You know, we don't have a picture on the website, and that's just wrong. But
I actually do have a really good picture of her cheerleading.
Oh, could you please send it to me? Send it to me, and I'll put it on the site. Because, you know, honestly, that has always baffled me. It's like, this woman is terrible under pressure. How the heck did she get to this position? So, yes, the fact that she was the company cheerleader does not surprise me. And we're sorry for all you smart cheerleaders out there who somehow slipped in unnoticed. and break the stereotype. So, you are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back. They said Hickey. Did they say Mickey or Hickey?
I believe it was Hickey.
I think it was too. Is this the General's theme song? It's fantastic. Wow. Who are the prophets who wrote this song? Who is this?
Tony Basil.
Well, I've never heard of him, but...
It's a her.
Oh, it's a her. Okay, obviously...
in the early days of MTV when they actually played music.
Oh, well, very interesting. Apparently they knew Allison Hickey was going to be the Undersecretary for Veterans Affairs.
It is, in fact, Mickey.
What are the odds of that? Huh.
And I must be polite, and I have to caveat all of my previous statements by saying... I have had to contact former Undersecretary Hickey on three separate occasions for extremely egregious claims for my veterans' issues. Each time I contacted her directly and I had communication with her directly, she made sure that the issue was resolved. And very expeditiously.
Hey.
I mean, light years comparatively to what is the norm across the nation. I mean, the average wait time for a claim is 2 to 4 years. So when I call her, I'm at year three for a veteran, and I call her and or email her, and I'm getting stuff resolved in weeks. Do I believe that she actually was out of touch? Not so much. And I have evidence to that effect.
I think Shinseki was kind of out of touch.
Shinseki was, I truly believe, was completely oblivious.
I think so, too.
To everything going on.
He actually told a guy that I work with, he's his sheriff now, but he served under him, and he had a chance to see him, I don't know, some gathering at some point. And he actually was shocked that the people in his command in Veterans Affairs were actually lying to him. He had never, as a general, a four-star general, I mean, that he knew of, people didn't just turn around and lie to his face and then go about their day. And so that was a whole new deal for him. But I think Hickey knew because she actually lied for them in some cases that I was working on, and she knew darn well what the answer was, and she actually posited like two or three different scenarios that were completely fiction with evidence in front of her.
Well, Aaron and I, you and I, worked on a case, a very well-known, publicized case, on where a particular regional office had
Oakland
hidden almost 15,000 claims. And I was actually in D.C. When we finally got it to CBS to do a story. That took us 4 months. God help me. because, you know, VA is not important to anybody, even though it's the second largest budget in the government and takes the largest chunk of tax dollars.
Oh, I didn't know that. Think that they're starved for funding, and it's like, no, they're not
starved. Well, that's
all
you ever hear is when there's a problem, they don't have enough money. They need more money to fix the problem.
No, say that again, Lauren. No. Give that statistic again.
It's the second largest budget in the government. On the budget lines, when you're talking about huge federal government budgets, the very largest budget in the government is the Department of Defense, which it has been historically since the First World War. So people get twisted about Reaganomics and all that crap. It's always been that way. The second largest is the Department of Veterans Affairs. And they have gotten, in spite of what many of the very far right think, for the last 9 years, the Department of Veterans Affairs has gotten every dime they've asked for, including emergency funding for things like Choice Act and other things that could start swinging.
Now, when you say budget, does that include the benefits that the veterans are actually receiving?
Yes.
So it's not just what it takes to run the administration.
They pay out, for veterans, myself included. I'm 100% disabled. I have a terminal lung condition that I contracted in Iraq. I also inadvertently crushed both the basal joints in both hands, driving convoys. Didn't know it till I got home, and they had to remove them. So I can't tie my own shoes. That's okay. I don't care anymore.
That's what got me.
I live in Florida. I wear flip-flops. We don't care.
Yeah, there you go.
Move to California. You'll be fine.
Florida, California, Belize, I don't care. As long as I can wear flip-flops, I don't need to tie my shoes. The biggest issue, though, is that is including disabled veterans, that is including their health care, that is including payroll and bonuses and everything. They've gotten every dime for 9 years. 9 years in a row. And the right will tell you every time, well, the VA is underfunded. My behind. I've got a right cheek that they can all kiss because I can show them dollars, absolute tax dollars, that the VA gets every year. What they didn't get this year was an additional $5 billion to fund Denver, the hospital from hell. That we have, the whistleblower came forward 4 years ago. His name, he goes by Dino. I'll just leave it at that. He goes by Dino. We have all of his records. He came forward 4 years ago. He went to the House committee. He went to the ONI. He reported all the corruption that was going on at Denver. Every lick of it. They refused to open an investigation unless he stayed in his job and kept quiet and got somebody on tape. Now we find that Denver is a goat rope, and Denver is a giant money pit.
I'm sorry, we didn't hear what you said after goat rope.
Out of the blue, and he's like, all he said was, I told you so. And everybody thought he was crazy. They tried to have him arrested. They tried to have him committed. They said he was insane. He's not insane.
Makes you want to be a whistleblower.
Yeah, another benefit.
The money that goes through the VA, if we took, and I'm going to give you the best example, one of our models that we developed, the Choice Act, at a long, hard-fought battle with the chairman's office on the House committee, because I did not want the Choice Act to go through, because we have, under current VA law, a thing called non-VA care, used to be called fee basis, in which they're supposed to pay for when a veteran goes to a civilian medical facility for care because the VA can't provide it.
They're supposed to.
They write law and make new law, and turns out to be a giant money pit again, $17 billion. $11 billion of that went to the contractors who hosed that mess up. And there's $6 billion left that the secretary wants to rape and dump it into his general budget. Except we have the process in place already. I have spent 3 years working on non-VA care bills for veterans. Veterans that, you know, 9 o'clock at night, they're having a heart attack. They go to a civilian hospital. They get med flighted out to a level one trauma care center, and they spend 2 months in the hospital. And the VA denies the bills for 2.5 years until the veteran's credit, their credit score is roughly around 390. Mm. And I'm on the phone with Congressman LaMalfa's office or Congressman Cook's office or Congressman Bilirakis's office to force them to pay the bills.
And they should do that under the fee basis program.
Exactly, and
as an emergency, right? I mean, if it's an emergency,
right.
and the person
is a life-threatening emergency, it's
sure.
supposed to be automatic.
And you know, it's funny because if you had regular insurance, you don't run into these kinds of things. I mean, when you have an emergency, it gets processed and it's done. But for some reason, that can't happen with the VA.
Well, and it won't happen with the VA. I will tell you, I've lived in both worlds. I was an Army wife for 11 years. Then I became a civilian and just lived out in the civilian world until I was 39 and then became a member of the military. Then I came home and I was a veteran. And I started in the VA process. And I started watching what was going on. And I met with risk adjusters for civilian insurance companies, who are the guys that tell civilian insurance companies how to keep their risk level down. I met with the founder of eSurance and had them show me exactly how claims have to be processed for workers' comp claims, which is what VA claims are, really.
Mm-hmm.
These guys opened my eyes, because when I saw what was going on in the civilian world compared to the VA... I go to civilian doctors. I refuse to go to the VA because they refuse to treat my lung condition. Doctor told me unless my PTSD was cured, I wouldn't get treated.
Really?
And there's no such cure for PTSD, so.
Why is that? Why would they attach the two? Why would they have that stipulation in there?
Well, the funny part is he is the fellow for pulmonary exposures for combat veterans at James A. Healy. That is his title, and he makes a high six figures to do so. To stand there and take care of those of us who've contracted some kind of lung condition while we're deployed. And he told me that he wouldn't even examine me. He never even put his hands on me, never looked at, took my blood pressure, nothing. And said he wouldn't until my PTSD was cured. The issue being, it wasn't about me. I didn't give a crap anymore. It was about, this is what my brothers and sisters go through. When you've got a veteran that has bona fide, highly documented combat service and highly documented combat exposures, the first order of business, according to an exposure letter issued April 26th, 2010, by the VA... they're supposed to comply and treat and reach. And they won't. They behave like a civilian insurance company who has tried to cut their losses.
Sure.
So they're using the PTSD as leverage?
They look at it.
So they use the PTSD as leverage to... finalize that claim before they take on a lung condition?
Oh, yes.
That's what they're doing?
And PTSD is the one thing that the VA will staunchly stand by, that we fake, that we lie about, that we manipulate. Yet, a RAND study, which I'll email to Aaron, a RAND study that was done by the DOD showed that less than 0.1% of soldiers and veterans coming off active duty were committing fraud on PTSD. And yet the VA refuses to acknowledge that. They refuse to acknowledge trauma exposures. They refuse to acknowledge, unless you're missing a limb, they don't talk to you. Mm. And even then, and this is why, like, Dr. Clancy, who has just now stepped back to her second position as the undersecretary, Dr. Clancy would not step in the middle of or talk about or publicly come out and direct anyone in the healthcare facilities to stop kicking our PTSD vets out of the emergency rooms. At the height of Phoenix, Dr. Clancy was named the interim undersecretary, and Dr. Clancy not once made a public statement saying, you will not do this. The level and breadth of corruption and malfeasance and absolute dereliction of duty that is happening within the VA system, the only pure cure for it is a complete overhaul. We've examined the contracts that employ all federal employees under AFGE, American Federation of Government Employees. The year that the backlog started was the year that a brand new contract went into place and a brand new set of parameters for how they got paid.
Oh, interesting.
And until that contract's gone, and until that contract is revised, to go back to the way it used to be, the backlog will never disappear.
Hey, hang on, Lauren. We need to talk about that some more. I have never heard that before. We need to take a quick break, though, because we're only 10 minutes overdue. Sorry.
I'm so sorry.
No. Well, I wasn't paying attention. I was listening to you. So we're speaking with Lauren Price. She is with Veteran Warriors. Their goal is to work with congressional leaders, Veterans Affairs Administration, and the veterans to bring about the necessary changes to the manner in which VA handles veteran affairs. And I think you can see Lauren's pretty serious about this. She's a good resource. We'll be right back and finish up the hour with her. This is We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
In a world without end,
stay frosty.
Like that ancient immortal said, don't want them to get you, go, don't show them where it's hit. That's just what I did.
Stay frosty.
Woo! Look out!
Stay frosty now.
Here's my hand, I won't look.
What does he say?
Stay frosty.
That's what I thought he said.
That means stay alert.
Oh, stay frosty.
But you missed the goat reference. That was
that
was the real reason I played it.
Okay.
Because we were roping earlier.
Lauren, when you said goat roping, I just want you to know you derailed us for about 5 minutes. We were here goofing off while you couldn't see us. you have to goof around a little bit with this stuff, or you wind up running around with a machete waving over your head.
No, you actually just sit in the corner and go,
Yeah,
then there's that option. So,
yeah.
Okay, so now tell us that again. I have never heard that, the change in policy and what that did creating and how that created the backlog.
I will make this really fast because this is for the benefit side only.
Sure.
In 2010, the union contract for all the benefit side employees came up for renewal. And the union representatives, the big guys in Washington, came in and said, hey, our people, we're 2010, we're starting to see a lot of soldiers coming back, stuff's getting busy. The employees don't feel like they're being rewarded for all the work they're doing. So what we want to do is we want to rework the way they get compensated. From the lowest rater, the very bottom guy, to the regional director, all those people in the middle, and there's about six levels of supervision that go on in the VBA, from the lowest rater to the director, and the VBA not wanting to rock the boat. and not wanting to have a mass walkout of 100-something thousand employees, said, sure, we'll, you know, we don't, because we're not going to look into it. We're not going to fact check that, you know, what you're saying. Sure, we'll abide by it. And they changed the union contract as to how each employee that handles claims is actually paid and compensated, including benefits and bonuses. What happened was it went from a case benefit process to, if you close a case, if you actually close a claim for a veteran, you'll get your promotion points or performance awards is actually what they call them. Two, what's called in the collection industry, keystroking.
And okay.
It's taken directly from the collection industry. It's called keystroking, and it means that if Aaron, you have a claim, and your claim has been sitting there for 6 months, it doesn't matter how long or what it's for, you can have 10 claims or one. I open the claim, I send you a letter. The keystroking that was involved in that process now creates a performance award for me. So they changed it to that, and that went into effect in January 1 of 2011. And from that point forward, and I actually have all the historical data, our organization actually put together, I took our bean counter guys, our data geeks, and I put them on that task, and I made them go back at that point, which was 2 years ago, I made them go back 4 years prior to look at where the backlog started and what caused it. Within 6 months of the new contract going into effect, the backlog started. Because they can open a claim, send a letter, yep, duly noted, we're working on your claim, and I can't tell you, there are millions of veterans that will tell me, yep, we're working on, I get a letter today saying, they've had my claim for 3 years, but they sent me a letter today saying, I'm working on your claim.
And then they tell,
they tell Congress that
no claims are more than 125 days old.
But they're in fact not doing anything, even though they just sent a letter out saying. So it gives the veteran the warm and fuzzy feeling that they're definitely working on it. Yeah, it's in the process, which it isn't.
And there's a second half to this. And actually, Senator Boxer, who has now decided she's not going to go for her seat again, Senator Boxer is the only one that actually asked us this question. Back in February, we went to D.C., and I met with Senator Boxer, and Senator Boxer asked us, we were talking about dependent claims. Dependent claims are called when you get married, you get divorced, you add kids, you have stepkids, what have you. Everybody in the world has these. And that the average wait time is 3 years to add your wife or your kid. Your kid's in kindergarten before the kid's added to your dependent, you're out of your status, which is, you know, it's a few hundred bucks. It's not a huge deal.
Still, what takes then, 3 years?
Senator Boxer asked us, she's like, why is this taking so long? I said, well, here's the problem. The VA has a standalone secondary system that adds dependents to claims because in most jurisdictions, they're official records, marriage, birth, things like that, are logged in officially in most jurisdictions. So they don't have to have you send these documents in, so no person has to touch anything. All they have to do is do a quick check through vital statistics. Yep, you got married. Yep, you had a kid. Okay, cool, we start paying you. 2 years after they started using that system internally, and that's, I have all their documents to show. They'd had it running up and running for over 2 years. They announced that we have this system. If you just go on here, we'll get you paid within 5 days. Senator Boxer, who's in California, heard a lot of flack from veterans saying, you know, I've been waiting 6 years for them to add my wife. another telling me if I just do this, I can get her get paid immediately the little extra stipend for having a dependent. But what happened to the 6 years I've been waiting?
Oh, and so it's not retroactive. It's going to be effective as of that day.
Sure, because they tricked him into going and putting it online.
That's actually under Title 38. In Title 38, which is the VA law, that's the Bible, it says that if the veteran files a second claim for the same thing, regardless of what it is, they file a second claim for the exact same thing, they take the new estate.
Sure.
And I actually have them saying, well, at some point, we'll go back and review. If you have another claim in for your dependent adding, we'll go back. Maybe we will go back and look at it and decide whether or not you're due any retroactive pay. And I had just had a case. This case just closed out 60 days ago. They'd been waiting 8 years. 8 years to add a wife and two kids. Two stepchildren. And they'd waited 8 years. And they didn't get into the new system. They waited until the whole thing processed through. They got almost $40,000 in retroactive pay. Because that's legitimately what it should have been. But that would have been gone, and that would have been in the coffers of the VA had they used the new system. And
that's incredible. Well, how many people are getting screwed out?
I guess the $64,000 question is, and we've got to take one more quick break before the top of the hour, but the thing that everybody asks is, what's the incentive? I mean, this isn't like it's their money. So why is
it? The incentive is the bonus money.
Exactly. So let's go into that a little bit in the last few minutes when we come back, because you've got to see the incentive in order to see. The method to the madness isn't there unless you look at the bonus structure.
Yep.
And they lie about that a lot. So we'd like to hear that from you. We'll be back with Lauren Price from Veteran Warriors. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Yes, and we've heard that before. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. I'm almost dying here listening to that.
You know what? Uh-oh. We wind up with a lot of... the VA is a treasure trove of musical fun for Bob. He never ceases to find one more new one. That's a new one. All right.
That was awesome.
So
that was so succinct.
See, that's why we can have fun while we, bash our heads on the table. So,
no.
Okay, explain
We're
this.
We're not the ones bashing our heads.
Well, that's true. We probably shouldn't, because if we do, nobody will fix it. But how is it that they, we have 2 minutes. How does the bonus deal work? Because they Congress has actually told them they're not allowed to pay bonuses, for starters.
And the VA said, screw you.
Yes, exactly, which
We're
is what they
do
usually
anyway.
Do. Gave them the finger and walked on is how I like to put it.
Yeah.
So, okay, how are they doing it, and how's it structured, as far as you know?
It's real simple. The lowest level rater doesn't get a bonus, but they are motivated by things like, truly, like pizza parties. things like that. They get a certificate for pizza or gas card or what have you internally, because the directors of the facilities get huge bonuses, and their immediate and second immediate subordinates get huge bonuses for coming in under the numbers. And it worked. And for those listeners that don't quite grasp this, it's no different than the wait list. I use this analogy. If an x-ray costs $1,000 and the head of radiology's budget is $10,000 a year, for him to get his bonus, he has to come in under budget. So he's only going to book nine x-rays a year. And everybody else gets stuck on these secret wait lists. It works the same in the VBA, the benefit side. If they touch a certain amount of accounts, if they actually do send out paper, these letters, on a certain amount of accounts, we've had letters generated that were completely false, as Aaron knows, that they were sent, they weren't even sent out. They were generated to dead veterans, and there was a mail code on the system shut off so that the mail actually never went out. But it looked like the letter went out to the veteran saying, we're working on your claim. But they still get their bonus, and they still get their $180,000 a year salary, and that's just start as a director. That's the bare rock bottom.
Yeah, that number, that for our listeners, that number would be familiar. You can look up at Diana Rubens. Hey, Lauren, we've got to jump off here. Because
we started on Ms. Rubens.
I know. We've had more fun at Ms. Rubens' expense. Okay, so we're waiting on a picture of General Allison Hickey as a cheerleader. And send me the PTSD study done by Rand. And then we got to have you on again on a different day because we ran out of time. Thanks a million.
And you know what? I so am so grateful for you guys having us on. And we so appreciate you having us on.
We love Veteran Warriors, and you help me a lot. Thanks. All right. Find all the info on wethepeopleradio.us. It'll be up shortly.